Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, we're happy to have with us Margarita Montemore, author of Una Out of Order, published in February by Flatiron. Una is Margarita's second novel. Her first was Asleep from Day. It was, Una is a USA Today bestseller, and it's a Good Morning America book club pick. And it's on the front desk of our bookstore, which is a shame given the time frame we're in now. But as I was just talking to Margarita, we're also delivering the book. So if you live in Meridian or if you live in the Potter Building or the Hankin Building, we can just drop it off anytime you'd like. Una's a wanderer through time, not of her own desire, but by a mechanism which kind of plucks her out of every new year and dumps her into a new time and place, sometimes where her mother is waiting or Kenzie's waiting, sometimes in the middle of a subway car. I don't know how Una or Margarita keep things straight over time, but they do. One thing that threads through the whole book is music. Great music, all the music I love. And to a certain extent, the stock market, for reasons maybe you already can guess. We all fantasize about time travel. Una gets to experience it over and over. And it certainly has its ups and downs, which may give us pause as to our own desires to participate in such a journey. So with that, welcome, Margarita, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be part of your show.
So should we talk about music for the next hour?
I would be happy to do so. Always a pleasure when people connect with the music, because I know it's, you know, some of the references aren't as well known as others, and so that's definitely something I've gotten to bond with over the course of the books being published with some readers.
Well, it's funny because the one thing that got me was, I mean, I knew everybody, you know, from Iggy Pop. I remember the Stooges. I had the Stooges album. Kate Bush, I've listened to Wuthering Heights. When I went through a breakup, I listened to it, I think, maybe 1,000 times. Lou Reed, I saw Lou Reed at the Main Point in Bryn Mawr in 1969.
Wow.
And same year I went to Woodstock. And the sound system wasn't working. And it went off once and he kind of said, okay. And it went off a second time and he threw his guitar into the audience and just walked off and left.
Oh, great.
But I'm just saying, I don't want to go on about the music, but I will anyway. The thing that pissed me off about what you did was I knew everybody, but I didn't know Candy Stranger. So I said, who is this? And then I go look on Wikipedia, I look everywhere and I can't find it. No, so and then I didn't realize, without spoiling it, what it was. It really got me confused.
Right. I mean, that Candy Stranger, for just for edification, is a fictional musician that there's a couple of mentions to here and there. But yes, every other artist and musician is real. And I found that it was a nice way to connect not just her identity, but also the timelessness of music. That, you know, sure, there are certain artists that are representative of specific decades or eras, but there's also a timelessness. So it was something that was able to serve as a constant for Una traveling through the different decades, whereas there were so many other unpredictable factors that it was one thing that she could always return to.
Yeah, it's neat because, you know, all the kids who work at the bookstore and my kids and my grandkids, everyone likes Pink Floyd. And it doesn't make any difference what generation. Everybody likes Pink Floyd. And everybody knows Comfortably Numb and Wish You Were Here. And that was nice because that reminds me. So when you were doing this, like I said in the introduction, Una and you both, I don't see how either of you kept it straight. Did you have one of those bulletin boards like they have at police stations with pins and then strings that go through the neighborhoods and all?
I wish, and one day I'm going to write a book just for the sole purpose of having one of those murder boards, because that is like, I dream about that. And from my previous novel, which I self-published, I had a wall of Post-its. Surprisingly, this one, I was able to keep track of it using Scrivener, just because it lets you, it's sort of like a digital file cabinet. So I had one document that was her leaps in order that I wrote the book. So as I wrote them, I would write down the year, her internal age, external age, and like the key things that happened. So I could keep track of her chronology. And then I had a separate timeline that was every year since she was born. And then I would fill in the blanks kind of with the leaps so that I could see how the leaps look to, you know, normal sequential time and, you know, who would know what, who she's met, who she hasn't met, what she knows, what she doesn't know. And I would also kind of pepper in additional ideas that I might have, some of which made it into the book, some of which didn't, some that might make it into a second book if I write it. So I was able to kind of, using those two timelines really helped me a lot in terms of keeping everything straight.
Well, it's kind of a good segue into not only explaining the book in terms of what it's about, but talk about how you begin each section with specific numbers and what those numbers refer to. And that gives you a little more of an idea about the book.
Right. So in the first chapter is 1982, 1818. So it's New Year's Eve, and when the clock strikes midnight, Una Lockhart is going to turn 19. She's in New York. She's kind of at a crossroads with her life. She needs to decide whether she's going to kind of pursue a more academic opportunity that's come to her, or a more creative, music-oriented opportunity. And so she has this big decision to make, and she kind of wishes that she didn't have to make it, and her wish comes true because at the stroke of midnight, she passes out and she comes to in the year 2015 in her 51-year-old body. And she discovers that every year exactly at midnight, she's going to leap or time travel into her own adult body at a different age.
Yeah, and it's interesting because one of the things that runs as a thread throughout the book is this idea of how she's able to, for the most part, warn, if you will, her next incarnation of what's about to happen in that incarnation. Explain that.
So since there's the Una's personal chronology where she jumps around in her own personal timeline, but then there's actual the straight line that time actually moves in. Una's able to, so for example, in 2015, her first leap, the Una that was in the year 2014, internally, she was older. And so she knew, okay, this first leap is coming up in 2015. I'm going to write a letter to Una to let her know kind of what to expect and give a sort of quick and dirty list of guidelines. It's a tricky balance because when you've seen the future, it's hard to have a life that's full of surprises. And, you know, she really wants to make sure that she kind of is able to prevent certain spoilers from happening, but also give her enough guardrails that she can, you know, live comfortably financially. So, you know, savvy stock market investments. And she tries to kind of hint at certain behavior or people she, you know, should, you know, avoid or kind of gravitate towards. And so, you know, you have this kind of wiser, it's like if you got to write yourself a letter that, you know, from a much younger age, like what kind of wisdom would you impart on yourself? And so it's this balance of trying to give her a life that's full of these surprises and meaningful moments, but also, you know, weather the more difficult times and kind of come to understand that making mistakes is also going to be part of what shapes you as a person.
What made me really sad in the book is that when you talk about the stock market picks, 1997, I had Google, I had Amazon, I had Apple, I had Microsoft, and I go, oh my God, $1 would be worth $1,000 today. I'd be I have $100 million, and so it made me feel okay. I had all of these things that the book, that the binder is advising me to get, and then I just ignored them because I didn't have the benefit of the year before. You even accounted for the splits in the stock, which really got me.
Oh, I did a lot of research because I wanted to make sure that, you know, the premise is already so fantastical that I really wanted to make sure that as much as possible was very rooted in reality. And, you know, I tried to kind of strike a balance. My editor's the one who actually recommended adding more information about the stocks. And I had a lot of fun kind of delving into the histories, like what would be the best investments, and you know, and hopefully I got the math right. I'm not as economically savvy as Huna is, but I think for the most part, at least you know, the years that the stocks split, you know, I really tried to ensure that was all correct.
Yeah, you did a really good job on that. Again, to my dismay, but the thing that's different about time travel in your book is it's not the kind of time travel where, like in that Ray Bradbury story, he goes back 100 million years and they step on a butterfly by mistake and that changes, you know, like the beating of a butterfly's wing. Una gets the chance to change things, and those changes don't necessarily change the space-time continuum. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? She doesn't necessarily follow that rule, but she does deviate from what her previous incarnation might have advised her to do. And it doesn't change things.
Right. Or you could argue that her previous incarnation tried to kind of guide her along a certain path because she had made these other choices. But Una being stubborn or sometimes wanting to make her own decisions or mistakes actually cements her fate by trying to subvert it. And it is the case with time travel where you kind of need to decide on what your philosophy is. And I love the notion of, you know, the parallel worlds and alternate timelines. For the sake of this book, I felt I needed to simplify certain things, which is why I didn't explain why the time travel happens, because then that has to become a central part of the book. It was more about how would time travel affect somebody who's just trying to have a regular life. And so, I did try to explore that notion of, sometimes when you kind of try to run away from a certain fate, you actually end up running right into it.
Right. How come the previous Una says, like, be patient with Edward? He's kind of like a nice guy. But he wasn't. I mean,
spoilers.
I always do that. I'm sorry. That wasn't a bad spoiler, though.
No.
So why does it seems like the previous Una sometimes pushes her theoretically in the wrong way? But then again, not to do spoilers. Well, especially the. Let's see. How can I say this? So with Dale, you can go into who Dale is and how that works. But like with Dale, that last time around, it would be really hard to kind of like not, you know, like when she's doing stuff and people say, how do you know that about me? How do you know that? How do you know this? Or she'll name a song and the song's not even out yet. Mm-hmm. Those are the things. You did really well because you didn't make them like really stick out a lot, but you made the reader understand that there was a disconnect here. So, and that must have been hard to keep straight too.
It also involved a certain amount of research. The tricky thing was making sure that every year that she was in, there was enough there to give the reader a flavor of, okay, this is what 1991 was. And, you know, whether it's through pop culture references, through what the technology is or isn't, through, you know, what people are wearing, what people are saying, but without making it just kind of too bogged down in the details. And yeah, I mean, especially when she goes from a year where she learns a lot about the future to a much earlier year, and she may not kind of have that. She's still young enough that she hasn't learned to sort of censor herself or really watch her words, that yes, she'll let some future slang slip or mention a band that doesn't exist yet or a song that doesn't exist yet. So it's these little, like what she calls social landmines, that she needs to navigate all the time. And then it works on the flip side too, where she's often thrust into these situations where she's around people who know her already, like, you know, ending up leaping to a year where she's married to this man that's a complete stranger to her. And she needs to figure out, okay, you know, how much do I need to wing it? How honest can I be in these certain situations? And, you know, and that's a learning process for her too.
Yeah. And I like I liked everything about the book. And I also like the idea that I can remember the names of characters, because whenever I can remember the names, I know I've read a good book. But like Dale or Edward, or Madeline, or Kenzie. So the idea was, like, you also, like, there was like these little stories who were like, okay, here's a romance story, like with Edward and what he does, mm-hmm. and the woman who's trying to run his restaurant and all that stuff. And that's like a little vignette that kind of fits into the novel. And that's interesting. Is that the way it started? Because I remember reading something about how you said when you edited it, like one third is completely different.
Yes. And that was actually the early version of the book felt a lot more like, kind of, as she says to herself in one of the letters, your life is a series of short stories. So a lot of the revision was about making it cohesive and having kind of more through lines. I mean, yes, it's definitely episodic because she skips around in different decades, and every year, you know, there are certain people that reappear, such as her mother or Kenzie, but there are other years where she's just, you know, she has all these different people in her life that are significant in some ways. So, initially it was a little bit more kind of, I guess, scattered, and then finding that cohesion, but also finding kind of like what is this arc as she goes from being a teenager into a young woman and kind of really comes into her own as a person under these circumstances, and how can I make that more cohesive?
Yeah, and the other thing is too, as she goes through time after time after time, she begins to collect things, and she has this shelf of tchotchkes kind of, I mean, not tchotchkes, because they're really valuable, but then she sees the shelf and something's missing, and she wonders why it's missing. And that also, I could never do that, because I could never do the timeline of keeping those symbols long. How'd you do that?
That was something too that I added in revisions to kind of tie everything together, like, because she has rules where she's not, she doesn't let herself keep photographs, so that she doesn't know what she looked like from year to year, what people were in her life, you know, again, no spoilers. That's one of her big life mottos. But at the same time, you know, she does have a closet that contains some outfits that she's worn in the past. And this sort of tchotchke, or, you know, this cabinet of knickknacks is her way of having a little reminder of every year. So for me, it was fun to kind of think of like, okay, what's going to be in that cabinet or not be in that cabinet. And then I also added a few knickknacks that are not in the book, that, you know, just as little Easter eggs of, okay, you know, this will be something for me to build off of if I do write the second book, like what is the glass igloo, or like the little Venetian mask, and what's going to be the story behind the Fabergé egg. So it was nice to kind of leave the question marks for Una, for the reader, and even for myself as the writer.
Yeah, I thought about that when I often thought about the sequel, because I was waiting for Una to come into a body that was like 80 years old. Mm-hmm. What if she came into 12 years old or 8 years old? And I wondered about that. I thought, well, did you think about that? Or, yeah, did you?
Oh, absolutely. And that's why I wanted to make sure that I set certain parameters. And One, I wanted to have it be her adult life. So she has lived a sequential life the first 18 years of her life, and then it's when she turns 19 that happens. Okay. So it's only her adult life that she leaps into. And then in terms of a much older body, for me, the tricky thing was I wanted to make sure that I wrote years that I actually lived through, or that, you know, history has happened in. So but I also knew that we needed, especially that first leap, you need to have the dramatic, like, many years gap. So I thought, okay, you know, a good middle ground, especially if you're 19 and you wake up 51, you might as well be 80. You know, I remember when I was either like 10 or 11, my parents were in their like 30s or mid or late 30s. And I said to my mom, I was like, oh, you're, you know, 30 something, you're old, you know? So, you know, I think that that would be such a shock for anybody. But also I wanted to make sure, again, so that I can use the current events and the pop culture, all of those touch points, and keep it very realistic. I mean, my goodness, if I had written about 2020, when I started writing this book in, you know, 2015, 2016, there's a lot of important stuff that I just would not have been able to guess at or predict. So, so I'm glad I kept it kind of to that, to those limitations. But I do have some ideas for the second book that where at least one leap would take her kind of further and give us a glimpse into what her later life looks like. And I also think that the second book, you know, one of the things that I wanted to explore with this first book is kind of the notion of aging and what are we supposed to feel like at a certain age? What is a 40-year-old supposed to feel like? What is a 50-year-old supposed to feel like? And what does that matter versus kind of the meaning that we create for ourselves in our life? And, you know, because she does kind of spend most of the book in her 20s, I think it would be interesting as she gets older and as she spends more time in her older self, to also explore the notion of, like, kind of that second chapter and how, you know, we, even just characters in books and shows, you know, mostly they're in their 20s and their 30s. And, you know, but here's, you know, here's somebody who's living a meaningful life in her 50s and 60s. And so I think that would be fun to really delve into.
I remember when I was a kid and I was reading all the science fiction stuff and I go, I can't wait till the year 2000. And then I go, oh, I'll be 48. What's the point? I would be so old, I wouldn't be able to enjoy any of it. And that really bothered me too. It bothered me a couple of times when she sees herself in this 51-year-old, old, saggy body. And I go, yeah, I was 51 once. And I didn't think I would. Now that I look back on it, it seems that was young, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. It's funny how that works. Oh, the other thing that's really cool is you can create your own time machines. And I did it too. I remember when I graduated elementary school and I was walking home. And I remember I was walking on the sidewalk and there's this little hill on the right-hand side. And I said to myself, no matter how old I get, I'm going to remember this exact moment. Mm-hmm. And I did it. And I have this link to that exact moment in my head. And that reminded me a little bit of the book, too.
Mm, that's great.
And the other thing that's cool is that, and this maybe you're thinking about in the sequel, is you never, this is not really a spoiler, you never really explore the mechanism. Mm-mm. Why is this happening? What is happening? Why is it happening when it's happening?
Yeah.
And I think that was kind of cool because usually you have to go into some kind of convoluted reason, some deus machina to have it happen.
Yes.
So that must have been
very intentional. And I gave that a lot of thought, and I went back and forth on it. And I just felt like there was no way to satisfactorily explain it without making it a larger part of the book. Because if you know why or how it happens, then you have to have some of the story dedicated to her trying to stop it and or reverse it and somehow, you know, kind of go back to living sequentially. And then it becomes a different type of book. And, you know, for me with the time travel stories, I feel like so many of them are about trying to prevent or change really significant events in history. And the stories that I really gravitate to, I mean, granted, I love pretty much all time travel stories, but the ones that really leave a deep impression on me tell the more personal tales and just focus more on relationships and identity. So I thought it would be fun to use time travel more as a way to explore something like imposter syndrome, where, you know, you wake up and you're expected to be this person, that, you know, at this age, and on the inside, you know, how many of us wake up feeling like we're totally a different age on the inside, and, you know, or wake up and this person that we've known for years seems like a total stranger to us. So it was a way to kind of take those familiar feelings and sort of magnify them under the lens of time travel and explore kind of these more personal issues relating to identity.
Yeah, and like you, in so many ways we seem similar, the music and the stock market. But the other thing is, whenever you start a new time travel book, you always think, well, how can it be different? There's so many of them. Mm-hmm. And how can there be a different premise and a different idea about whether your past actions or you're going to meet yourself as a child, that kind of thing. But in this one, you're swept into it. You kind of never really ponder that. You never really think, oh, why is this not happening? Why is this not happening? It's just different, and you accept it. And I don't know how you were able to do that. You slip past something.
I don't know, to be honest, because I have such a great admiration for anybody that's able to write a time travel story, and especially like really complicated ones, like the movie Primer still just turns my brain into a pretzel every time I watch it. Or, you know, certainly I loved The Time Traveler's Wife and Stephen King's time travel book. So I think that it's really just, for me, it was a matter of, I guess, my way of coping with getting older and kind of coming to terms with that. You know, initially it started out as an excuse to indulge in my nostalgia. Like, hey, if I write a time travel book, I get to revisit these years and she can be whatever age that I make her in these years. And kind of as time went on and I wrote the story and, you know, the character grew and my thinking evolved too into realizing that, you know, there's something important about being every age. It's not like, you know, your life ends or the, you know, your purpose ends. It's about always discovering what that is. And there's a part of the book where Una comes to the realization kind of later on where she realizes that every year they're going to be, she's going to lose something or someone every year and gain something or someone. So, you know, that every year has its advantages and every year has its drawbacks, whether it's a person in your life that's no longer there because you haven't met them or they've passed on, whether it's technology, whether it's just that life wisdom or youth. You know, it's really just about kind of navigating and trying to recognize, like, what are those advantages instead of thinking about everything that has passed and all the things that we no longer have or all the times that, you know, are now behind us. So it really helped me approach life in a much more kind of mindful and optimistic way, I think.
Yeah, it's funny because right before I read the book, I was talking to someone about meditation or something like that. It's always cool in the bookstore because you always have different people to talk to and they always have different stories. Well, so, and we were talking about living in the moment, you know, kind of a cliche. Mm-hmm. And I try to think about that, but like maybe two or three times a day I can live in the moment. Like, and that's it. I can't do more than that. But that's what Una's mom is trying to impart to her on several occasions in the book. And I don't know if Una entirely succeeds, but she's moving in that direction as the book progresses, mm-hmm. I think.
And she really has no choice because, I mean, granted, her moments are made up of year-long periods, but, you know, that's really, she's going to have to find a way to make peace with her existence and the fact that it is so episodic. So, you know, if you begin a year in a relationship with someone, knowing in the future you're no longer with that person, you know, that's a choice of, do you try to avoid that relationship entirely in order to kind of, you know, sidestep the pain and the ending of it and knowing that it's going to, you know, it is going to come to some kind of conclusion? Or do you enjoy the benefits and just the those happy moments, knowing that, you know, it is still going to come to an end? And I mean, I think really, when you look at life, there are no guarantees. Just because we live sequentially, it doesn't mean that we can predict what's to come, you know, or just, it's pretty much, we take it for granted that the day that we live today is going to look the same as tomorrow and the day after that. And, you know, whereas kind of really taking that moment to recognize, like, okay, this is what today is, and what can I do to really make the most of it? Again, that's something that I struggle with to this day, but it's definitely during the course of writing the book, it's helped me. And especially right now in these times, I see readers responding to the book, and it's so great to, you know, see that they also are taking away, like, okay, it's so important to, you know, live in the moment, make the most of today. And so I have to keep reminding myself to do the same thing of, like, all right, you know, like, I need to take a page out of this book, because that's how, you know, we're gonna kind of make it through this more uncertain, difficult time.
Yeah, and one of the things that many of us are doing during this time is going through possessions and getting rid of things, and because you have nothing else to do in the house, so you clean up, do projects. So the hardest thing in the world is getting rid of pictures, photographs, mm-hmm. and I have so many of them. You can kind of cheat now because you can always take a picture of the picture on your phone. But I look at one, like Samantha and Annie, when they were like 6 and 3, and I took them to the Nutcracker, and they're standing on either side of the Mouse King. Wow. And I don't like, all my life, I haven't liked doing that because it makes me sad. It makes me really sad because that was then. And then I'm not saying you did this, but now I kind of look at it like, okay, that happened, and it was a really happy thing that happened. So, okay, that's what it was. It's not like it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And I can't take myself back there, but I can. And then, okay, the picture memorializes it, and maybe I'll take a picture of it, but I don't need the picture. It happened in my life.
Oh, I'm a digital hoarder. Like, I also, you know, every picture, and I mean, I have a really, really tough time getting rid of, like, any books or, you know, especially anything with sentimental value. I have, like, boxes of letters and little mementos. And I am generally a very, very nostalgic person, whether it's, you know, rereading my old diaries or, you know, looking through things, or whether it's just kind of looking back, like, I love everything to do with the 80s and, you know, glamorizing that decade and how I was born too late to fully enjoy it. But I've had to kind of, it's like a drug, nostalgia, where, you know, it's so easy to kind of indulge and overindulge to the point where you're living in the past. And, you know, I think finding that balance of reliving those memories and having that pleasant moment versus letting it kind of overwhelm you to the point where, you know, you're just kind of, if it prevents you from kind of moving forward or living your day-to-day life, like, I found that it's better for me to kind of enjoy nostalgia in smaller doses or use that nostalgia towards some kind of purpose. Like, if I am using it for a writing project or research for, like, what a particular year was like or period in my life was like. So I try to kind of be a little more spare and utilitarian when it comes to nostalgia. And I found it's working well for me so far.
Yeah, the thing I've learned about books is they're really heavy. And so your life is basically moving mass around. And yeah. First started my first bookstore, I was thinking, okay, I'll get all the books out of my house, but it's not like I'm throwing them away and taking them to a bookstore. And then when I went home, they were all still there, you know, because you just keep getting them. And you can't, you know, you can't put a book into the dumpster. You just can't do it. It's impossible. And so now I have a bookstore and I have all these books at home, and my kids aren't going to want them. They're not going to have any desire to have them, but there is no way of getting rid of them. And it's just,
I think of them as like they're the twigs that make up my nest. Like for me, being surrounded by books is what makes me feel cozy and at home. And I mean, yes, my bookshelves are really, you know, we've got some double stacking going, and you know, I do need to do periodic culls. It's so, so difficult, but I always make sure that I donate them, and that, you know, I do everything I can to, you know, find a new home for them. But I don't know, I feel like that's something that anybody, I think, is justified. You know, there's no such thing in my book as having too big of a library, and having more digital books, more ebooks has definitely helped me, but I'm never going to stop owning physical books. And I think, you know, for me to have that sense of comfort and home, and to have those physical objects in case there's a blackout, or just, you know, whatever it is, just to still be able to hold physical books in my hand, nothing will ever, you know, come close to that feeling or completely overtake it.
Yeah, and the other way I've always looked at it is, you know, it's an addiction, but it's better than crack. You know, so if you're going to be addicted to something, being addicted to books is a really good addiction.
Absolutely.
And the other thing about, since I also have this, well, because I think I got it, a NetGalley. Yeah, I did. I got a NetGalley of it. So the other thing is that when you read it on your iPad or your Kindle or whatever device you use it on, one, I can find out when Kenzie's name first appeared in the book, if I'm trying to, okay, where, or I can take notes for the interview, or I can look at a word that I've never seen before and get it defined. There are lots of really cool things about that.
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, and you know, even the last vacation that I went on, I'll always bring physical books, but being able to bring my tablet with me that had like 50 books that I uploaded specifically for the vacation on it was fantastic. And so, you know, having suitcases that don't feel like they're completely stuffed with bricks, that's definitely an advantage. But again, like for me, it's both. Right now, I've been reading more ebooks just because the dog sleeps in the bedroom and is sensitive to light because she's a little princess. So having my tablet, being able to kind of hide it under the covers and not disturb her, that's sort of become my habit now.
Yeah, and you're right, when you travel, I don't want to be taking Sapiens or the new translation of Don Quixote, you know. It's like, it's 10 pounds more to lug around. I'm never going to do that. I'm never going to take a big book with me.
Yeah.
It's just not worth it.
Yeah.
Hey, so let's talk about, I love epigraphs. So let's talk about yours, because it's like, it's kind of like a gnomon of the book, because, and it's by two really cool filmmakers. But do you have it in front of you? You want to read it?
Okay. Yes. Okay. It is, so it's actually, it's a quote from the movie Wings of Desire, and it's translated from German: time heals all, but what if time itself is the disease?
Yeah, and so at first I thought that was somewhat pessimistic, but then as you read the book, it's much more understandable. And it doesn't mean, like, you know, it's a disease that's a fatal disease or anything like that, but it's also something that we're all stuck with, you know, we're stuck with it. And as I said in the introduction, there are its ups and downs, and you've delved into that to a certain extent as well. So I thought it was, how did you come up with that? Did you write the book and then come up with the epigraph, or did you always think of that in the back of your mind?
Wings of Desire is my favorite movie of all time. And I, since I saw it when I was 17 or 18. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, this is my favorite movie. And it has remained my favorite movie ever since. And there's so many different quotes from that, you know, I love. But that one in particular always just kind of stuck with me of, and just the dichotomy of it, that, you know, we always try to, like, just that saying, time heals all, this too shall pass. But, you know, it's at the same, you know, at the same time, time is the thing that is slowly kind of eroding us. And, you know, we're all, you know, at the mercy of this clock. So exploring, you know, I thought it was just the perfect setup, especially because she refers to her condition as, quote unquote, time sickness. Because, you know, the way that she experiences time is, it's abnormal compared to everybody else. So, so I just thought it was this really, really good balance. And like you said, it, even though, yes, it's the sickness, it's the disease, but it's also kind of, we have to find the cure within that as well. And like, we have to make peace with the time and kind of learn to make time our friend, even though it's everybody's enemy kind of at the very end.
Well, it kills us all.
Right.
How come you made her wake up that one year in the subway car?
That wasn't originally the way that she kind of came to. That was one of the things I changed. I realized that she, because a number of the leaps, she's in her house, that, you know, the Park Slope brownstone. And so for me, I wanted to challenge myself to think of what are some more unusual settings where she can leap. And there was one that I really loved, that it was a leap I had to cut from 1985, where she begins the year in Times Square, in the middle of Times Square in 1985. And of course, she's like, why would I possibly be here? What was I thinking? But it just, that whole section, it just didn't work kind of to give that cohesiveness with the rest of the story. So as I was rewriting it, I was also challenging myself of like, okay, what are interesting places where she could come to, but that aren't going to feel contrived, where there would be even though in the beginning she's like, why in the world would I be on the subway? Sooner or later, it becomes clear like how and why that happened. So kind of, I wanted to marry logic with novelty.
If I remember right, so like her mom is kind of like her Virgil in Dante's Inferno, you know, it's like kind of her mom kind of, and then how come so often she's lucky enough to come back to a spot where her mom is there? And what made you decide that? Because her mom is such a big portion of her life.
Yeah, I mean, really, my mother is one of my constants, and I definitely drew from just the personal relationship that I've had with her. So for me, if I think of like, who is somebody that you could have that's always going to be there for you in your life, like at your toughest moments, like it's a no-brainer that, you know, a mother is like the first thing I think of. And I know I'm very fortunate to have that experience. And I also felt like, okay, she's going to go through so many hardships and so much uncertainty that she needs to have this one person. And to be fair, Madeline, sometimes at the beginning of the leaps, she's not there. Like she sometimes turns up a little bit later because she is still a free spirit and she likes to travel and she loves taking her little vacations and whatnot. But, you know, in a pinch, you know, she will always be there. And she's in this tricky position. And it's something that my mother and I experienced as well, like, you know, being immigrants, but, you know, I had a better sense of the language and, you know, like my mother struggled learning English more and, you know, being a teenager, every teenager thinks they know everything. So there's this Russian expression, she'd always say to me, oh, the egg is trying to teach the chicken. So we definitely had those moments of, you know, who's the wiser one, who can teach the other one, and like, what can we learn from each other is sort of the point that we evolved to. And I thought in the context of Una's circumstances, where sometimes she is going to be older than her mother, or she's going to be wiser because she has seen the future. She has experienced things that her mother has no way of knowing will happen. And so she has a different type of wisdom. And again, like using that more metaphorically for the way that a paternal, you know, like a parent's relationship with their child and the ups and downs that they go through and the learning experience that they both have over the course of the years was an interesting way to explore that.
And then the other side of the coin is that Mackenzie is there many of the times. Mm-hmm. And the Mackenzie story is another one that could have easily been maybe it started out to be a short story. It could be a novella where, you know, you go through this entire cycle of, but what you did was you wove it in between so that it reaches a resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny because how in the very beginning, in the first jump, you know, he's this other thing, and then he gradually becomes this other thing. So I didn't spoil it.
Right. Well, so with Mackenzie, I wanted to have the kind of the bookends of, so her mother is like the older, wiser figure, but especially for that first leap, it would also help for her to have somebody who is younger, who can kind of be her guide, but is young enough to also take her around the city and clue her in on technology and slang and, you know, here's what's going on, like, in the world of pop culture, in the world of, you know, here is the internet, welcome. So I thought it would be a nice dichotomy to have, like, you know, even though he is, in a way, kind of older and wiser than her in the beginning, kind of as her assistant and her confidant, like, she needed somebody that she could also connect with that isn't necessarily a peer. I mean, it's ironic, you know, she's in her 50s, he's in her 30s when they first meet, but, you know, she still feels like a kid and she's learning everything that he has to teach her. But then in later leaps, the roles are reversed and, you know, he's much younger. And, you know, so their relationship also kind of, it follows these different peaks and valleys of, you know, kind of where they take turns guiding each other and helping each other through certain really difficult moments.
And well, nice subtleties you did too. Like the first time when he goes, you know, we've been friends for many years. And then also I thought, well, she's hugging him too early. She shouldn't be hugging him yet. And I thought, well, now I understand at the end, you understand why. I mean, there's this ineffable quality. And that's another aspect of the book, that there's this kind of ineffable quality that even though you haven't experienced something or the other person hasn't experienced, there's something that is there, you know? Mm-hmm. There's something that's there that, I don't know what, if you're talking about the Trinity, it's not God, it's not the Father, the Son, it's the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit, like that.
Right, and then I also think that, yeah, sometimes, you know, it is tough for her when people already know her and she's, you know, she's always playing catch up to what everybody else knows. But with Mackenzie, because during that first leap, he's so open with her and patient, and he just really just opens this world of, okay, you have so much to catch up on for, you know, these decades that you've skipped over, but, you know, not only am I gonna like help you through it step by step, but I'm also gonna like be your guide and around the city, and we're gonna have like fun moments too. And so like, just, you know, she does have this immediate kinship with him because he's so generous with his time, with his patience. And so, you know, it's like a baby duck imprinting on somebody, you know, like there is this innate connection that even though he's known her much longer, the more time passes, the more she sees, well, of course, like, you know, it's, you know, we already have this bond, and, you know, she gets to rediscover it from the beginning and understands it too.
Yeah, it's interesting that there are so many things in the book that allow you to have expectations of a sequel or maybe even a trilogy. I don't know about, maybe even, but there are so many aspects of it. And what I like about, I told you about remember the characters' names and stuff like that. Another thing I like about the book is that you leave a lot of the work to the reader. I like books that leave work for the reader to do. Like, where she's going to go, where is she going to go next? And I wonder who she's going to meet, or who she's already met and has to change a relationship with. So you left it more than almost any book. You leave it wide open for the reader to just daydream about it. That's kind of cool.
And it's funny, when I remember when I was in high school and reading Hemingway for English class, our teacher would tell us how, you know, Hemingway's writing style is like an iceberg where 1/8 is above the surface, 7/8 is below. So you're only seeing what you're reading is the very, very top of that iceberg. And I remember feeling so frustrated, like, 7/8, that's kind of not fair to make the reader infer that much and do that much work. So for me, you know, as I grew up as a reader and a writer, you know, I found that the fiction I gravitated towards was, you know, not all surface, but not all kind of glacier either. And I like that balance of, you know, we're in this together. So I'm going to give you, like, let's say 50-50, or like, I will give you as much as I can, but I think I trust your intelligence and your imagination to fill in certain blanks. And yeah, I think that is part of the joy, is trying to figure out kind of, well, what would happen after, you know, the last page, or, you know, what are these in-between spaces? What do these other leaps look like? What does the conversation of Una first telling Madeline about her time sickness, what would that look like? And so it's something that I also kind of, it gives me pause, and it gives me mixed feelings about writing the sequel, where, you know, I want to still kind of leave those empty, those question marks there for the reader to ponder. And at the same time, kind of makes me curious of, like, can I do it justice and really give her, you know, another story and extend her story in a way that would still kind of provide enough details and enough different aspects under the surface to make it satisfying for a reader.
Well, the good thing is you have all the time in the world.
sometime, but, you know, it's definitely fun to think about.
Oh, there's so many cool things you could do. It's funny you mentioned Hemingway, because I remember when we had to read The Old Man and the Sea, and I was like, this is so easy, you know? A 12-year-old could read it and all that. So you read it and you go, you know, like, these are words of one syllable or two syllables most. And then you finish it and you think, okay, well, that took me a couple hours. But then you could spend the rest of your life pondering. Or you can write like Faulkner. I mean, you could be as dense as, yeah, I know. I can't do it. But yeah. But yeah, so you read that and you're thinking, you know, this is just kind of like a really, and I tried writing a story about a fisherman one time and writing it that way. It's really hard. It's really hard to write that way. And yes. There is not 9/10 of that book is underwater, and the reader has more work there than in almost any book that I've ever read.
Yeah, and I mean I can appreciate that about, you know, certain works of literature, but, you know, for me, I try to write the types of books that I enjoy reading, and, you know, it was the same thing with, like, you know, as much as I love time travel, like, what's a time travel story that I wish existed? Like, that was kind of one of the questions simmering in the back of my head. And just in terms of the writing itself, I guess the way that my philosophy, or the way that I look at it, is I want to give readers a story that, you know, will engage them just on a pure level of, you know, characters and plot, will, like, make them want to keep turning the pages. However, if they want to go beneath the surface, there is more glacier there. There are other themes and, you know, symbolism and other areas that they can explore and look more deeply into. So it's there if you want it. And if you don't, if you just want the time travel adventures, that's there too. So, you know, and it's something I definitely appreciate about books that I read that can marry those two things of like giving you the substance and giving you the thought-provoking elements, as well as giving you that story where you are just super hooked in and engaged the entire time. It's definitely a challenge to write it, and as a reader, I love books that are able to accomplish that.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing, well, there's so many questions I still have, and we have to close it out, but the other thing is that, yeah, you see into her mind, you know what she's thinking, but then the other part of you is going, how does she manage this? Mm. How does she manage to do this? And then you start wondering, well, could I manage this? How would I go about figuring this out? How would I go about treating people that I've already known? Do I have to just repeat exactly the way I did before? Would I be able to fake this, so to speak, you know, for a whole year? And yeah, those are the kinds of things that I ponder, and I think everybody else will too. So.
Yeah, it's been such a great adventure to kind of, you know, write this book and then see what the response has been and the different reactions and questions that come up, and it keeps me sort of, keeps the gears in my head turning too, and I love it.
So the last question I'll ask you is, which I've been asking everybody I've been interviewing, is, I mean, when you wrote this, you expected, okay, now I'll be on tour and I'll be doing this and doing that, and now you're not. You're stuck talking to me.
Oh, I was very fortunate. My book came out the last week of February, and I had a week of launch events. So I visited three different cities, and the attendance was not affected at all. All three events were just fantastic. I had an incredible launch week, and I didn't really have a lot of everything else that I had planned was actually either virtual or just, you know, online interviews or, you know, Q&As, things like that. So I know that I'm in a very unique position that, you know, my heart goes out to authors who just had books coming out or, you know, are about to release books. But I think that we have to adapt no matter what. And personally, like, I love having virtual book club meetings. And, you know, that's something that I was planning to do anyway. Unfortunately, I have some local book clubs that I would have loved to meet with face to face. But you know what? We still get to talk face to face. And doing interviews via video chat, to be perfectly honest, it's not the worst thing in the world to be able to wear pajama bottoms and still kind of do all the promotional activities. So again, for me, I look at it, I try to view it from a more positive side of things. And so for me, being an only child and a bit of a homebody, having this, being forced to stay at home, I've adapted to very, very well, to be honest.
Plus, you can hang out with your dog and you can order food while you're doing all this stuff.
If my dog, my husband, you know, he's an artist, I'm a writer. The things that we love to do the most involve being in a room and doing them. So really, other than taking the dog for hikes in the woods, you know, she's had to make more adjustments than we have to some extent. But you know, we've been weathering it just fine, and we'll keep doing so as long as we need to stay safe.
All right. Well, while you're there, you could, if you want to, start the sequel.
I actually have made some notes.
Well, thank you so much, Margarita, for being here. I really enjoyed talking to you. I literally do have other pages of questions.
Oh, my gosh. It was such a pleasure, and I do hope, you know, once things are a little more stable and normal, to visit your bookshop one of these days.
Yeah, if you want to, we can go to Westchester and have dinner and then come here.
That would be fantastic. So thank you again. It was really a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you. We were talking with Margarita Montemore. Her book, Una Out of Order, which is her second book, is an excellent time travel book. You know, usually you get these time travel books and someone goes back and meets themselves as a child or something like Back to the Future. And you know, you don't get tired of them, but they have the same kind of thematic thing. Like if you go back in time and you change one thing, it's going to alter the future inextricably. But this one's different. And once again, at first, it has this picture of a woman on the front, girl, and you might think this is a book for girls, and it's not. And it's really cool. It's about this woman who goes every New Year's Eve at the stroke of midnight. She goes back to a different time in her life. She starts out when she's 18, then she goes to 51, then she goes to 35. And it's really neat the way she divides each jump up. It came out in February, so you'll be able to, you can get it. It's not like one that's going to be released after I interview. And then trying to think of what we have next. Like I was saying in my last interview, it's great now in one sense, even though it's horrible. These authors can't go on author tours anymore because of the coronavirus. So they can't sell their books. So they're more than happy to do interviews. Rebecca's always gotten great people, but now we can really get great people because they have to get their book out there and they can't go on tour. Plus, I've got them sitting on the table in my bookstore, but my bookstore's shut. So other than me delivering them around here, which there's lots of places I can do it, luckily enough, but other than that, there's no way they can get the books. As we come out of this thing, you know, I'll be able to do curbside pickup and all that, but it's still not the same. As you all know, you're all in the same boat. So in any event, we have a bunch of them coming up. The one I did want to mention is a debut novelist, C. Pam Zhang, who will discuss her highly anticipated novel, How Much of These Hills is Gold. And the coolest thing coming up is, although I don't get her directly, is there's a prequel to The Hunger Games. So the publisher of Scholastic Books, Suzanne Collins doesn't do interviews. So the publisher of Scholastic Books is going to be interviewed the day the book comes out. So at midnight, I'll sell them on the curb, midnight the 19th of May. May. It comes out 12:01, the 20th, just like the old Harry Potter books used to do. And yeah, so I get to interview him and talk about it. And if you go online, you can read excerpts from chapter one. It starts about when Snow is a kid before he turns into this horrible dictator. And he's like, it's kind of like Anakin Skywalker before he turns into Darth Vader. And so anyway, I get to talk to the publisher. But if you go online, you can find not only selected part of chapter one, but there's also this incredible trailer, like a movie trailer, and it's really well done. So that's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. You know, Scholastic, between Hunger Games and picking up originally the Harry Potter series, they were almost going to go bankrupt, and now they've got to be the richest publisher in the world. So be that as it may, thanks as always for joining us here on The Avid Reader, and we hope to see you again next week, especially in these trying times. I'm not going to say the same thing like, you know, stay safe, because duh. Yeah, that's the idea. But I hope we come out of this soon, and hope you'll be back at the bookstore when we open it up. So see you later.